Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. Dr. Williams is the author of the acclaimed book, Shattered by the Darkness, Putting the Pieces Back Together After Child Abuse. Dr. Williams is on the senior leadership team at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. And Dr. Williams travels the United States speaking and training professionals, parents, and victims about the importance of dealing with abuse and personal trauma head on and not being afraid to break the silence of your own personal pain. Feel free to call in to tonight's show at 888-627-6008 and speak with Dr. Williams and his guests live on air. And now, your host, Dr. Williams.
Well, good evening and welcome to Breaking the Silence. I'm Greg Williams from the most beautiful city in the world, Houston, Texas. And you can look right outside the window. I'm just looking down on Texas Medical Center's drive, right on straight on down. This is one of the few times on a Sunday night about this time that you see zero cars. Come about 8 o'clock in the morning, there'll be hundreds of cars lined up trying to get into the medical center. But it's just great having you with us on this Sunday before Thanksgiving. I hope your belly is ready to receive some food, but most importantly, I hope your mind and your spirit is ready to give some thanks and gratitude for what you've had this year, for what you've experienced, good and bad, for what you learned from it. And I just want to let you know, while we have these few seconds, I appreciate each and every one of you that listen each week. I'm already getting texts. And this just isn't right. So, hang on, let's get the show started. Already getting that text wanting me to ask some questions to the doctor that's going to be on tonight. So this is going to be good. There's people listening already around the world. So looking forward to this program. And you can join us each and every week at 8 o'clock Central Time live right here in Houston. And I tell you what. There's two or three different ways to get involved tonight. One, you can just sit back and enjoy. I do think tonight's one of those nights, and I say this just about every week, but this is true tonight. I believe you me, that if you want to have a blank piece of paper and an ink pen, because you're going to get wisdom about a subject that probably you know very little about. I've read cover to cover, and I learned so much stuff, and I have so many questions. I'm excited about our guest. But it's probably something that we use, are involved in every single day of our life, thousands of times. And we have no idea how important it is, but we're going to talk about it this evening. You can get involved by watching on Facebook. You can get on there and watch it. And you can also comment through there. I believe my son is running this from Japan tonight on the other side of the world with the United States Army. He has it up and running tonight, like just like clockwork. And I appreciate Curtis doing that for me, my youngest son. You can get involved there, put a comment on it. You can text me, like some are already doing that right now, 832-396-6525, and that rings right here. Or you can call the BBS radio station and the wonderful personnel there and the staff, 888-627-6008. And they will patch you right through and just say, hey, we have a question and love to have you come on and comment. And this is going to be one that I believe you have a lot of questions and just want to take this information in. Let's just all be a dry sponge tonight and let's soak up all this wisdom that our guest tonight has years and years of research on. So it's going to be awesome. I always like to start the program off each week with either something that I was thinking about this week or something that I've been involved with, something that affected me. And I tell you what, maybe as we go into the holidays, and I don't want to really date this program to talk about specifically Thanksgiving or whatever, but I think there's some times and some areas in our lives that I think is just good wisdom, good protection, good mindfulness, good self-care to put boundaries around us. And I believe I have a book here, my second book somewhere laying around here on the table that I wrote. And I have a whole chapter, and I call it guardrails, just because I didn't want to use the same line that everybody else uses about boundaries. But we need to put boundaries around ourselves that's going to protect us, guard us from things that we don't want or shouldn't allow or won't tolerate to come into our arena, our area. And the first thing, there's a few steps here that I learned this week or wrote about this week, and I just wanted to kind of share with you real briefly. First, I think it's important that when we start setting boundaries for ourselves, that we need to listen to ourselves. You know, what's really important to you? What's really going to matter to you? And I know a lot of people waste a lot of time on this, playing games, watching videos, posting on Facebook. LinkedIn is a new thing, but it's turning into a Facebook arena, basically. I used to think it was a wonderful networking tool, but now it seems like everybody's just promoting themselves and they're not wanting to network. They just want to say, hey, buy something that I'm trying to sell. I really don't get involved in any of that. But then, you know, the games you play and TikTok and the amount of time that we put into this, is that really going to matter 3, 4, 5 years from now? Is it really going to make a big difference in your life if somebody really liked you or didn't like you or follow you or didn't follow you? So really determine upfront when you're setting boundaries, what's important to you? What really matters to you? What's a value, and how do you place those values in your life and in your heart and for your goals? Second thing there is, what are your needs? What are some of the things that you need to take care of for you? Are you feeling right now resentment, anger, discomfort? And if you are, those are signs and signals and alarms that you may have some poor boundaries that need to be realigned. You need to have that emotional surveyor to come in and literally survey where you want those property lines to be and say, hey, wait, you can come up to that point, but you're not going to get on my front porch emotionally. You have that control. So determine upfront to listen to yourself. I'm stepping on my own toes and I'm preaching to myself tonight. Number two is learn how to say no. And that is so hard. There's so many times that people, places, organizations will call and ask, and very rarely do I ever say no to anything. And I think it's time in my life as I'm starting to get, there is some gray hair. It used to be just pitch black, but it's not quite that now. But now is it starting to get grayer? And my number, and you know, I'm on the other side of my last half of life. I've been up to the peak and I'm heading downhill and it's going fast. I promise you that. But I need to learn how to put my priorities in alignment and learn how to say no. And I need to really work on that. I really need to make that a priority. Maybe you need to do to yourself too. Give yourself permission to say no. And you don't have to debate. You don't have to over-explain, or you don't have to defend yourself on when you say no. Can you do this great? No, I'm sorry, I can't. Will you do this? No, I can't. And be willing and able to say that word. It's not a four-letter word. It's only a two-letter word that we treat like sometimes in our life, like it's the worst four-letter word in the world. If they're going to only like you and support you when you say yes, then maybe they're out for something that they're not as understanding or sensitive for your priorities, and they only want to get something for themselves. Three, allow room for a little bit of flexibility. Life is a balancing act. Too rigid Now, one, this is worth writing down here. Too rigid, you risk isolation. I've been there, done that. I had so many boundaries around me, and the walls were so tall that I pushed everybody away and would not let them even get close to me because I was guarding and protecting what I could guard and protect in my heart. And because of that, I was isolated for years. Yeah, you could be in a room full of people and still be alone because of that isolation, because you never let anybody in. And then if you're too soft, you risk exploitation. People taking advantage of you, people hurting you, people using you for only one thing. And when in doubt, when you're making these boundaries, go back up to step one. Listen to yourself. Perfection is not the goal because it's never going to happen. When we get into a holiday, Thanksgiving or Christmas, and you're preparing the meal and you got the stuffing warming and you got the mashed potatoes and the gravy's boiling and the turkey's in and you're wanting absolute perfection, go ahead and get accustomed that something is going to be dry. Something is going to be overcooked. Something's going to burn. It will not be perfection. And when you set your life up for perfection all the time, you're setting yourself up for a disappointment. Life is not perfect. I am an example of that. And I have the scars to show you that it's not. And teach people, I think this is an old Dr. Phil line, teach people, train people how to treat you. Don't let them treat you any way they want. Know how you want to be treated and teach people how you should be treated. And remember, the only people who get upset about you setting boundaries are the ones who are benefiting from you having none. And then finally, especially this week, be kind to yourself. Give yourself a little grace. Give yourself a little room. Allow yourself a little time to breathe and set boundaries for yourself. Let that be a lesson this week that maybe we could all use. And I promise to try it. I got a little here, right here on my little note. I promise to try this, and I hope you do too. So that's why I've been writing about this week, thinking about, studying about. I just wanted to share that with you. I tell you what, I am thrilled to have with us Dr. Stephen Furlick. I knew I'd miss it up, but we'll let him pronounce his name. He is the author of a book that is absolutely phenomenal, Nonverbal Epiphany, Steps to Improve Your Nonverbal Communication. This is something, be honest with you, I've heard about. Every now and then we'll have some training on it somewhere where somebody will come in, but I've never heard it in this way. I've never seen it presented in such great graphics and pictures that this book has. And I tell you what, Doctor is a best-selling author of the breakthrough book. He also, the sex talk book, How Biological Sex Influences Gender Communication Differences Throughout Life Stages. And I think this book even goes into that in some detail between men and women and how they communicate. But I'm going to drill down deep into that. And he has been an associate professor at Texas A&M University, yes, since 2018, and served as an assistant professor there for 5 years prior to that. He travels around, he does conferences, and people are waiting in line to get his books. And you'll want to get his book before you log off the show tonight. And it is my privilege to welcome the doctor to our program tonight. Can you hear me, doctor?
Yes. Thanks, Dr. Williams.
Hey, good to see you tonight. How's everything going with you there?
Thanks. It's going well. And I'm excited to talk about this topic. And I'm glad your intro feeds into it nicely as well.
Well, you know, there's some things that when I've read in your book, it was like, how in the world are you going to be able to pull out epigenetics and nonverbal communication in the DNA. How in the, you know, and I want to get into that if we actually turn the corner on the second half of the program, because where in the world, and how many years have you been researching this topic? Because you are a communication expert, correct?
Yes. So from early on, as I grew up, I always had an interest in nonverbal communication. I just always found it fascinating to understand people well beyond what they say. And then I took classes in undergraduate with my undergraduate degree, and then as a graduate student as well. And then as I became a faculty member, I started to research it to create original ideas and original research involving nonverbal communication as well. So I've taught a class, Nonverbal Communication is the title, not the most original, but it fits well and people understand what it is, for over the last 10 years. And early on, I always used someone else's textbook for the first few years when I taught that class. And one of the things that I had problems with was finding a book that really met my needs. So I either found nonverbal communication books out there that were more popular culture, that were outside of academia, but it wasn't really research-based. So again, how much credibility can you put into some of the things that they were suggesting or some of the findings that they had? So you had that outside of academia, popular culture, but it's a little more applied, which everybody likes. But then on the other end of it, I would use textbooks, and it was research-based. But then again, it wasn't nearly as applied as what I would have liked. So I try to balance the two with my book, Nonverbal Epiphany, where it's research-based, but then it's what people can actually use in their everyday life as well. So I support everything that I present throughout it with sources, academic sources, and then I try to relate it back to people's personal lives and examples. And then there's an activity at the end of each chapter that people could do to actually improve their nonverbal communication, both understanding other people and their own behaviors that they exhibit as well. And then I have over 150 images that help people visualize it as well. So it's that combination together that really struck me and really drove me to write this book, was having something that's research-based, but that people could use in their own personal life as well. So with your introduction, I think it fits nicely when you're talking about boundaries. That's what this book is about, is understanding what other people's true intentions are. So trying to identify what their true intentions are, and friend from foe, and who's there to help and who's there that is a possible threat. And just going by what they say is not enough. Oftentimes, their behaviors indicate what their true intentions are much more truer than what they're actually saying.
Wow. Okay. So do you find yourself playing Sherlock Holmes or Barnaby Jones, or I'll go through all the other detectives if you want me to. For instance, when you first met me just a few minutes ago and I did a little introduction, do you find yourself sitting back going, okay, he looked away during that time at the camera, he did this with his head when he said that. Do you see yourself analyzing, not only hearing the words, but analyzing the way I'm saying them and presenting them to? And what did you notice in me that was good or bad?
And I think that's one of the things to consider when you read this book. Think about where you are before you read the book, what you know and what you understand about other people, and then see how you grow throughout each chapter and then at the end as well. And I guess, to be honest, a little bit of it is difficult to actually turn off. So once you are aware of that information, then you're pretty much always running it through your head. Okay, this is what the nonverbal behaviors that I'm observing, and how does that fit into a more complete understanding? So if you don't mind, I could go into a few principles I think everybody should probably learn and understand as some general guidelines in pretty much all communication situations.
Absolutely. Go for it.
Okay. So here are some principles that I think everyone should keep in mind when it comes to nonverbal communication. And with some of these, people are a bit misled. So one of the things that I think that most people are under the impression of is nonverbal behaviors indicate what your reactions are to other people's messages. It's more of a reactionary of indicator of what your emotions are and how you respond to the interaction taking place. So that's true. That does serve as a reaction. But what you also want to keep in mind and remember is it also creates your emotion as well, just like some of the things that you were talking about. So there's two different short little things I want to get into just with this one principle. Now I'm going to go into a few other principles. One is her last name is Cuddy, C-U-D-D-Y. And I cite her in my book. She really has done numerous studies that have shown that your nonverbal behaviors actually create the emotion itself. So one of the things that she gives an example is that they did a study. They had a number of participants and they did like mock interviews. And they had people who were part of the interview judge each person who did the interview for them. And they didn't know the difference between the two groups. In the first group, what they had was before they entered the room, they had each person do a power pose. And the power pose was where they had their legs spread a little bit apart, their hands on their hips, their elbows out. And then what she found was when they did that power pose, it increased their testosterone level. And what that did was it gave them more confidence. And then also lowered their cortisol levels, which is their stress hormone. And then the other group, they did nothing. And again, the people who interviewed these people didn't see who did it or who didn't. But in the first group who did the power pose, they rated them as much more credible and it's much more likely to get the job that they were interviewing for because their nonverbal behaviors created those types of emotions that they want to set forth the power itself. So more confidence because of the testosterone increase and lower stress. They were more relaxed by having the cortisol levels decrease. Another study was done, and they had two different groups of people. And this is something that you're talking about in terms of creating your own world, your own destiny, your own, how do you want, your own image. So they had two different groups, a lot of participants. And in group one, they had them place a pin in their mouth. And in group two, they did nothing. And then they evaluate the emotions between the two groups. And between the two groups, who do you think raised their emotions more positively? Group one. Why is that? Because they had a pin in their mouth. And what did that do? That created a smile. So just by creating an artificial facial expression, you take on the emotion of the expression that you're that you actually have. So if you're not feeling that positive, if you have a bad day and you just start to smile, that creates more of a positive type of emotion for yourself. If you have more of an open posture, having your arms open instead of crossed, not having your legs crossed, having a more upright posture, that can create more of a positive type of emotion for you as well. So that's one of the principles to keep in mind is that it's not only your nonverbals indicate your reactions to what's happening, but they also create your emotions as well. Another one that people are often misled about is they overemphasize maybe a particular nonverbal behavior. So you don't want to place too much emphasis on one nonverbal behavior. I always teach our students that's more like a puzzle, and you're putting and you put individual pieces of the puzzle together to create the overall puzzle of what your overall assessment of someone, what your overall assessment of the situation. And just because someone looks down or someone scratches their nose or something like that doesn't indicate or mean on itself that maybe they're being dishonest or untruthful or whatever else. But you want to look at all the different individual pieces of evidence together to come up with a much more informed assessment. Something else on that line is you want to look at the context. So what's the time? What's the place? Is it public or is it private? What's the subject you're talking about? And who are the people present? What's the relationship of those people? And all those dynamics influence how people are going to act based upon different circumstances, different people, and in different types of environments as well. something that this is probably a good principle to keep in mind, that most people mistakenly understand this, and that you want to understand what people's nonverbal behaviors are much more so than what they're saying. That's usually an indicator of what truth is to that person, much more so than what they're saying. So believe what their nonverbal behaviors are, and also what happens first and what happens quickest. So those are some things to keep in mind as well, is what's their first nonverbal reaction. That's usually what's truer, and their nonverbal behaviors overall, generally speaking, are usually truer than what they're saying. And it's usually more often correct than what they're actually saying verbally. And then lastly, just a principle, understand what the other person's nonverbal behaviors normally are, and then see if it alters or changes based upon a given circumstance, maybe something that you want to see, are they being honest or not? So these are just some general principles. And then as we go throughout the show, we get into more specifics and specific behaviors and context and things like that. But I think these are just some general things that people should keep in mind in all circumstances.
You know, I think I have a book there right beside my recliner over here that I bought. It was on clearance at Barnes & Noble a year or so ago, about how to be able to tell when somebody's lying. And I have never read it, but it's there by my there if I ever need a book to read. I'm normally reading all week long anyway. But is there absolute? I mean, for instance, I don't know if you ever watched the old To Tell the Truth, when they go down and number one, what's your name, please? And can you tell if people, when they say something and their eyes shift over while they're saying it, whether it's, you know, what's the biggest telltale sign if somebody is not telling a complete line of truth?
So that is a good question. And I think one of the probably one of the most important things to take away from nonverbal communication and in life itself. And just to start off with that, most people are not very good at determining with accuracy deception of other people. And trained people who are like FBI agent informants, interrogators in the military, police officers, they're only about 60% accuracy. Those are the people who have not read this book. I'm just kidding. That was just a joke I was throwing out. So as you can see, how difficult it is even with trained professionals. So I have a few general guidelines and principles to keep in mind that I think if you put these pieces together, you should achieve much higher than what the professionals are of 60%. And the first one is, and this is biological. There's one caveat, I'll throw this out there, that it's very difficult to get participants to participate in a study. Therefore, it's hard to get a large number. So this is, you could take this pretty much as an absolute truth for right-handed people. That's because that's what they've studied. The majority of the people are right-handed. So probably it applies to left-handed people as well, but they just don't have the large enough sample size to say. But those people who, well, when someone's recalling something and they're talking about a particular topic, if they look to the left, and again, you know, for right-handed people, put that caveat in, then that's usually the truth. And if they look to the right, that's usually something that they're imagining, or it's something that they're trying to create that didn't happen itself. So looking to the left, it's usually a strong indicator that someone's being truthful. And then someone looking to the right is usually something that they're trying to imagine or something that they're trying to fabricate that didn't happen. Just on that note, I'll just throw this out there before I get into a few other principles, is how much detail do they actually put in, and especially sensory detail. If they leave out a bunch of sensory details because they didn't experience it, they didn't experience the colors of what they saw in the environment, what things looked like, what things sounded like, what things smelled like, what things taste like. So if they leave that out, and even if you ask questions, sensory information, and they're very vague about it, that could be another indicator. Another one is that they tend to furrow or lower their eyebrows when they respond as well, and that could be an indicator of deception. One of the biggest things that you want to keep in mind, again, what we talked about with one of our principles is baseline. And that's one of the things that you talked about. So you want to talk about some normal average conversation with them at the beginning. And how do they normally communicate about truthfulness, the weather, sports, what's a popular topic of the day, who Taylor Swift is dating and which football player, you know, get some average response from them, and then go into what you want to find out specifically, whether or not they're being deceptive, and seeing if they communicate differently than how they normally communicate with what is average information that they're being truthful about. What is something that's interesting, and this is pretty well established in the communication research, is that when someone's being deceptive, they usually use simpler behaviors, so not nearly as many nonverbal behaviors, and it's much more repetitive. So why is that? That's because it takes a lot of cognitive effort to think about what is not truthful that you're trying to portray as being truthful, and also do nonverbal behaviors at the same time that look spontaneous and genuine. So they're going to do fewer behaviors, and it's going to be the same ones over and over because they just don't have enough mental energy to think about that and to keep track of what their lie is as well. Also, what we talked about with our principles is it's less spontaneous. So the responses are usually less spontaneous, is less natural. And what happens usually takes more time. So you have more vocal fillers. They pause much more so. And it takes them more time to recall what they just said and what they're about to say that never happened. And on that note, one thing that you may want to do, people usually rehearse deception in order. So just a scenario. There's a couple, and one person of the couple, they go out for the evening. The other person's suspicious. So the person says they went out to, they met with friends, went out to eat, and then saw a movie. So if you ask, and people usually recall their deception in order. So if you ask them to start in the middle, they met with friends, but you ask them where did everybody eat, who showed up when, what was the restaurant, what did everybody order, how did it taste? So you get in the sensory information, you start in the middle, and then you go back to the beginning. It's very difficult to go out of order from what their lie was, of who met, at what time, when, and then go to the end of what movie did you see, this, that, and the other. The last thing is there's actually a much more accurate human detector out there. And it's called female. Females are much more accurate with detecting deception than what males are from an early age. And we could go into more detail into that later, but these are some general principles to keep in mind that I think should ratchet up the accuracy much higher than 60%.
That's amazing, because that's exactly where I want to go on the other side of this commercial break that we're going to take right now. Is I want to talk about the difference between men and women. And I was fascinated with the one graphic that you have, the color. You know, I love the color purple, but I never thought of it being violet, lavender, and all these other ones that women, when they think of the color purple, they go through all these different colors. I just like purple. And just that one graphic was like, I studied that for I don't know how long. It's like, this is fascinating. And we're going to talk about more of the difference and how can we maybe better communicate with the opposite sex, with our spouses, with our friends, with our coworkers that are the opposite sex. And I'm really interested in also them having that extra layer of sensitivity. And then I'm going to talk about the importance of just the eyes. And we're going to do all that on the other side of this commercial break, 888-627-6008. We'll be right back in about 102 seconds. We'll be right back.
From HCI Publishing, that brought you the international bestsellers, A Child Called It, and the Chicken Soup for the Soul series, comes the latest book by Dr. Gregory Williams, Shattered by the Darkness. This book describes the horrific abuse that Dr. Williams suffered at the hands of his father for over 12 years, and the damaging effect of keeping everything silent about that abuse for 30 years. If you're looking for that book that you can't put down, then pick up a copy of Shattered by the Darkness by Dr. Gregory Williams at all Barnes & Noble stores, Amazon, and Books A Million. Now, back to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams.
Welcome back. 888-627-6008. We have our guest tonight of the book Nonverbal Epiphany, Steps to Improve Your Nonverbal Communication. And you want to get on Amazon tonight and type in Dr. Stephen. I'm going to spell the last name, F-U-R-L-I-C-H. And you're going to find a couple books on there. Doctor, how many books have you written?
Just those two.
Those two. But the first one was like, wow. I mean, it really took off by storm, right?
Yes. So the first book is, it's called Sex Talk, How Biological Sex Influences Gender Communication Differences Throughout Life Stages. And I just try to be a bit humorous and a play on words. So how your biological sex influences your gender communication. So I just try to go through how brain structural differences that now science can actually analyze a human brain with over 90% accuracy predict if it's male or female. So how those differences influence communication differences, and then sex hormones as well, where actually prior to birth, sex hormones can predict your social behaviors later in life as well. So with males having 20 times more testosterone than females and females having 20 times more estrogen as males, how that plays into it, and it plays into this book as well, Nonverbal Epiphany, because what's been found is that estrogen actually helps social ability, understanding other people. And then testosterone has been found to actually hinder social ability in the way we understand other people as well, which makes sense since testosterone is highly associated with aggression and individualistic behaviors and things like that.
So nonverbal communication between genders varies extremely, correct?
Yeah. So what has been found for years and decades consistently in the research is that females from an early age, they have more interest in social interactions. So they look at faces as a baby much more so, whereas boys look at objects much more so. And then throughout life, they have more interest in, and there's just not much of a comparison that females are just so much more socially more aware and more equipped biologically that they're just superior nonverbally from an early age to understand other people, to empathize with them, and then also to communicate their nonverbal behaviors much better than what males can as well. And I could go on some of the biological reasons if you want.
Oh, sure. Because this fascinates me, because I think anytime you're in a relationship, husband or wife, and, you know, if we ever doubt our wife's judgment, you need to remember who she married, because you don't want to ever do that. I think it's just good wisdom even to bring them in, especially when you're making deals with them, arrangements with people, to have that other opinion that could have more knowledge than what we could ever grasp. I think it's just good wisdom. I think that's why maybe the maker, the divine creator, did that to allow them to complete us. But yeah, let's get some principles on the difference between male and female, and it's not nonverbal communication.
Yeah, just like you said, I think there is a biological complementary aspect to it. You know, males overall generally are a little bit better in some areas, and females are better generally overall in other areas. And this happens to be one of those areas that females consistently are better than what males are. And this is one of the things that have aggravated me over the years and why I wrote this book in academia. is that it's been found consistently that females are superior with nonverbal communication. And then academia always tries to explain it away as social learning, that the way that you're brought up or the family or society, and that's 100%. There's no other possible explanation out there. And that's just not true. The evidence out there suggests otherwise. And that's what I'll get into now. So one of the things that was really eye-opening to me, and as far as I'm concerned, what I'm about to say, this science is already settled, that the connections, the brain connections, are different between males and females. So for females, they have many more connections across both hemispheres, and that's pretty much settled as far as I'm concerned. And males, we have more connections within each hemisphere. So what that does is for females having connections across both hemispheres, many more of those, it allows her to engage in the conversation at hand while at the same time analyze your nonverbal behaviors. Whereas with us males, we're much more compartmentalized, where we have connections within each hemisphere and we could do one or the other, but expecting us to do both at the same time really is expecting too much from us. Females, they tend to have overall more white brain matter. And what that does, it allows more communication to the different areas of the brain. So for her having more connections across both hemispheres, having more white matter, that helps it communicate the different areas much more so. So maybe it's the language with the emotion, with the memory all together. And also having more senses. Her sensory ability is superior. All five senses have been found consistently to be superior as well. So with smell is more sensitive, touch is more sensitive, taste, what she hears. And with hearing ability, it's highly correlated with estrogen. So what's that do biologically? So when at her peak time in her life of reproduction, her estrogen is highest. And that's when you need to be able to hear the different nuances of the baby itself to understand what's the baby's needs. And then when her reproduction likelihood decreases, such as menopause, that's when estrogen starts to decrease as well. So it's not nearly as important to have that hearing ability as what she did when she had that newborn of what the baby needs. A few other things during social interactions. She has more mirror neurons that are activated during social interactions. So what the mirror neurons do is you look at someone else's nonverbal behaviors, then your mirror neurons, they activate. And it prepares your body to display the same nonverbal behaviors that you see someone else display. So she has more mirror neurons and she has more gray matter in the mirror neuron areas. It helps her not only activate her mirror neurons, it helps her process that information and it helps her body prepare to display the nonverbal behaviors that she sees someone else display much better than what males do. So it helps with empathy. You actually experience a more similar type of emotion as the other person because your body is going through the same types of experience as the other person. So if you have a similar emotional experience, then you understand and empathize with the other person much more so as well. Something else that's been found consistently during social interactions with females, they have much higher, this again, they have more interest in social interactions, human, social interactions. They have higher levels of oxytocin during those social interactions. That's that bonding chemical. So they feel more of a connection, more of a relation to the other person. So if you feel a connection to the other person, what do you think is going to happen? They're going to empathize and understand the other person much more so and understand emotionally where the other person is coming from. They also have more overall brain activation during social interactions. So not only more connections to the different areas, not only do they communicate better with the different areas with the white matter, but the overall more of the of her brain is activated during social interactions, which helps her again take in sensory information, process it, while at the same time engage in the conversation with language, while at the same time tie in past memories as well, all at the same time. Just some hard evidence, if you're not convinced yet, that females are superior with nonverbal communication. They did a study and they showed numerous pictures of only the eyes of people of those pictures. to both males and females, and there's not much of a comparison. Females outperform dramatically what males did of labeling the emotional state of the other person just by looking at a picture of their eyes alone. So they could take in much more information with less and process it with less information than what males are able to. Another thing that they found as well is through touch. They had a curtain set up. They had people reach their hand across the curtain and touch the hand of the other person. And females, again, outperformed what was the emotional state of the other person, much more so than what males, again, just from touch alone. One of the things that is, and we could get into relationships in a second, but a pretty strong indicator, a barometer, if you will, of relationship quality. And then as you go to holiday parties, maybe Thanksgiving, maybe Christmas, whatever else, look around at the couples and see who's on a good emotional state of each other. Positive nonverbal behaviors that mimic each other is a good indicator of a positive relationship. So if each person in a relationship are exhibiting similar positive nonverbal behaviors, that's a good indicator that that relationship is going well. Something that's a cautionary tale for take for whatever it's worth, whoever it may be useful for. It's been found that there is a negative correlation between mimicry of a person with another person who's not your romantic partner and love for your romantic partner. So person A is in a relationship with person B, and person A mimics the behaviors to a high degree of person C, then that's an indicator that the love for their person B that they're in the relationship with is much lower than if they don't mimic the behaviors of person C that they're not in a relationship with to a much lower level. That's an indicator. And you talked about this, and we could talk more about it in a second, that color vision. So color vision, part of it is on the X chromosome. And with females having two X chromosomes and males only having one, you can see how they have superior color vision. And they can see much more on the spectrum, different shades where we see maybe a few colors, and they can see variations of those different colors. And then also they have more P cells in the retina as well. And that's highly related to detail and color as well. Lastly, when it comes to vision, there is a saying out there, slogan, whatever it is, in the animal kingdom, those that like to hunt, their eyes are in front. And those that like to hide, their eyes are on the side. And that holds true for males and females of humans. So like to hunt, eyes are in front. Males have much more of a vision that's straight ahead. And females are much more comfortable and much more better at peripheral vision to the side. So oftentimes you would see females much more comfortable talking to a male at their side. And us males, we tend to like to face someone straight ahead because that's what our strength is when it comes to vision as well.
Wow, there's a lot of information there. And what do you, if you was giving advice to a young married man that was just getting ready to marry his young bride, hey, when you get into this relationship, this is what you need to make sure you're aware of. What, I know the principles were great. What's some of the things that really the men just absolutely miss when it comes to communicating with the opposite sex?
So I guess just to start out with somewhat of a humorous anecdote I put in my book, that the best style that a man can use is chosen by a woman because they're much superior when it comes to color and detail and things like that. With my first book, I have a chapter that I think is pretty informative with that in terms of early relationship types of things. And it's called She Demands and He Withdraws. And that's a conflict type of dynamic that is commonplace in most relationships where the woman demands more from the relationship and the man feels that he's not being valued and that she's personally attacking him, so he withdraws even more so. So you probably saw this play out, and everyone else has, in the popular media and various types of situations. If you go back to the Johnny Depp and Amber Heard trial, there are specific examples. She even has a recording that came out in the court. Every time we have some sort of conflict, Johnny, you just get up and leave. There was that birthday incident where she had her friends at the home. He comes in, he didn't like something, so he just leaves and sleeps somewhere else. But what happens with that dynamic is that she needs to understand that we're not as equipped to self-disclose and bring in and tie in emotion with past memories and the current topic all at once, again, because we have a much more compartmentalized brain and because testosterone hinders language ability. So we're just not as equipped to express our emotions at the same level as what females do. So she's highly invested in the relationship emotionally because they have more brain activation in the emotional areas of the brain during social interactions. Females do. Just one study out there. They had subliminal negative faces, and they found out much more brain activation for females when they looked at a negative face that they weren't aware of that they were looking at than what males do. So at a subconscious level, it's not social learning. And then what he needs to understand is that when she talks about certain issues, the task at hand, but then she also brings in what happened in the past, and she ties in emotion, she's not off topic. That's what makes sense to her, tying all those things together. And she's not just personally attacking you, but you should appreciate what she's bringing together because she's trying to better the relationship that us males tend to overlook. So some of the things that can be done with that is they found out that touch prior to conflict leads to more positive types of outcomes for that conflict itself. So maybe holding hands or embracing each other or arm around each other, that tends to increase the oxytocin levels between both people. And the oxytocin levels helps each person, that bonding chemical, empathize with the other person, and it helps to build that relationship. So touch prior to conflict. And then also one of the things that I talked about previously is mimic behaviors. So having similar positive nonverbal behaviors that are similar to each other, that also increases the oxytocin level for each person, that bonding chemical, but it also activates similar areas of the brain, which makes sense. You're exhibiting similar areas. In order to do so, you need to activate similar areas of the brain. So then again, you empathize with the other person and you take on the emotion of the other person much better. So she demands, he withdraws is a conflict that I think a lot of people should be aware of when they see it. And recognize that both people, what he does is his contribution to the relationship, and she needs to recognize that. And what she exhibits emotionally is how she contributes to it as well. A few things that in a relationship you should probably be aware of, that nonverbally with mimicry, it's much easier for her to adjust her behaviors to his than it is for him to adjust his to hers. So again, we just don't pick up the nonverbal behaviors nearly as well, us males. So it's much easier for her to pick up on it and adjust hers to his to make that united type of relationship with them. Also, the relationship stages themselves, what science has found, the different stages that it goes through is that females usually initiate interest with a subtle nonverbal indicator, standing closer, fixing their hair, longer periods of eye contact. And then after that, they expect the male to pick up on it and take the lead from that, escalate the relationship from there, taking the lead as the man and taking the next steps forward. That if he doesn't recognize those subtle nonverbal behaviors, then she often gets frustrated and feels that she's not being valued in it. And one of the things that you talk about with therapy and stuff like that, that it's important for couples to mimic each other's nonverbal behaviors in couples therapy and not to mimic the therapist's nonverbal behaviors. If you see that one person's mimicking the nonverbal behaviors of the therapist and not the couple, you got a long ways to go. But if you're starting to progress and mimic each other's behaviors, that's a good one. And then just lastly, One of the things that you talked about early on in your show, if a child is being interrogated during, let's say there's some sort of investigation going on, a criminal investigation, the nonverbal behaviors of the interrogator can actually influence the answers that the child will give. So if the nonverbal behaviors of the interrogator encourages the response, the child's going to give that response. If it discourages the response, then it's not going to give that response.
Unbelievable. I tell you what, we are completely out of time. I have thoroughly, Doctor, enjoyed this. And I didn't even get to any of my questions hardly. I'd love to have you back on. I want to reread the book. I wanted to get to the eyes, and we just don't have time tonight. But I tell you what, I need to work on some things in me personally as a man and get on the same level because we just sometimes miss the boat and completely miss the target, and it's not deliberate. And thank you for allowing that wisdom to come across that scientifically, we just don't have everything it takes to keep up with them. But I appreciate the information. This was fascinating, fascinating. Nonverbal epiphany. You want to get this book, and I promise it's going to just make your life better. Thank you, Doctor, for being with us.
Thanks, Dr. Williams. And just one last final thought, maybe.
Yes.
On that gender note, this is just my opinion, so take it for what it's worth. I think sometimes since males, we oversimplify things. And sometimes females, they may overanalyze or overcomplicate things. And we need to empathize, understand the other person's perspective, that she reads in the subtleties and we take things literally.
Very good. Thank you so much. I appreciate you being with us. And I promise you, I'll be back in touch to have you back on because I want to finish the conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate the time. As we always do, and happy Thanksgiving to you also. As we close every show out each week, and I tell you what, this is one of the money back guarantee books. You're going to want to get this. And I promise you, it's going to maybe even make your relationships better and more understanding and unbelievable, unbelievable. And I'm so glad we had the guest on tonight. Thank you. As we do each week, we always want to let you know that no matter what happens this week, no matter what you're going to face tomorrow, no matter what you're going through right now, I just want to let you know there's always hope. There's always hope. If you just don't have the communication act together, if you're just disconnected from all realms, this type of book, this kind of wisdom, will maybe open your eyes to be able to learn how to understand, learn how to communicate, learn how to process this in a different way. And men, stop being so hard-headed, doggone it, and be a little more loving and understanding. But I always want to let you know there's hope. Join us right here next week for another edition of Breaking the Silence from Houston, Texas. God bless. Have an awesome Thanksgiving week, and don't forget to love on your family and tell them how much you appreciate them. Good night. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. To contact Dr. Williams, dial 832-396-6525 or email him at shatteredbythedarkness@gmail.com. And don't forget to join us each Sunday night at 8 p.m. Central Time, 6 p.m. Pacific on BBS Radio Station 1 for the next episode of Breaking the Silence.